I really appreciate this opportunity and this very, very kind introduction by you, Cecil. I want to thank also Joanne Hinch, who has agreed to help keep you from falling asleep by giving another voice to what I'm presenting. She's going to be reading some excerpts from the book that Cecil referred to. I also want to make a special thanks to Dan Newhall for being willing to read the scripture and offer the prayer today. Dan and I share a great concern about HIV and AIDS, since he and Dodie had a son who died of AIDS, and some of you who are newer may not be aware of that. So thank you so much for that. I really am grateful for this opportunity because a lot of you here knew me back in the 70s and 80s when Cecil and I were living in the LA area and I was working with the National Farmworker Ministry. And so many of you knew me probably as I was trying to organize you to send food up to the farm workers or something of that nature, and also doing writing over, really it was a 20-year period that I was involved in that ministry. But in 1989, I was feeling that I needed to make some kind of a change, and I really didn't know what it would be. But I had a sort of longing to be able to do something that would be more one-on-one, which was very different for me. I hadn't been involved in one-on-one work at any time. And Cecil suggested that I try some volunteer work. And so I was thinking that over. In the meantime, I had spent quite a bit of time with Chris Glosser, who was the director at that time of the Lazarus Project. We were writing books at the same time, and we would get together about once a week to exchange ideas about our latest chapters. And he would often express how painful it was for him to be losing so many friends and to have so many friends getting sick and knowing that they would die, because at that time people were dying very quickly. So I made a decision that I would volunteer with APLA, AIDS Project Los Angeles. So I checked that out, and what they needed was hospital volunteers. And I was really fairly hospital phobic, actually. I had over a 3-year period had several surgeries. Both my knees were operated on. I'd had an ear surgery. I'd had a hysterectomy. I didn't like any of those experiences, and I did not want to be in hospitals. But I said, well, okay, if that's what they need, I'll take their training and I will give that a try. So in May 1989, I started as the APLA volunteer at the small Daniel Freeman Marina Hospital, which was near our North Inglewood home. And I went on a regular basis. Sometimes I would sneak in an extra time, but on a regular basis I would go 2 afternoons a week to see the patients on a new dedicated AIDS unit with about a dozen rooms altogether. On the first day, Burl, who was the unit supervisor, introduced me around as the APLA visitor and took me to meet the 4 patients that were on the floor that day. They were David, Tom, Mark, and Neil. From that first day, I kept a journal. I would visit and then I would go directly home. And I would kind of hold it together while I was there, but I would go directly home and sit at my computer and journal over the experience that I had just come away from. And that was when I would shed my tears and get fully in touch with how I was feeling. And so I have asked Joanne to read the several brief entries I made about Neil over a 5-day period.
May 18th, Thursday. Martha took me down the hall to meet Neil and his mother, who was from Bellevue, Washington. Neil looked awfully sick and didn't feel like talking. He had a nose tube to help his breathing. He resembled his mother. They both had brown hair with a lot of body. Hers was flecked with gray. Neil's was cut in a butch, and it had grown out quite a bit. His mother said that she and her husband were going home that evening. I had an urge to tell Neil that I could be around like a substitute mother, but I knew that really wasn't true. I was a comma inserted into this man's life. I knew nothing of what had gone before or how it affected the present. And no one knew what would follow my comma of a moment. A little later, I was walking down the hall, ready to leave the hospital. Neil's mother came walking toward me. I stopped and said, "It must be hard to leave." She acknowledged that it was, but they had to get back home. She mentioned wishing Neil's Presbyterian Church was more active in visiting him. She seemed so happy to discover that my husband is a Presbyterian clergyman and had some things in common with her and her husband. She rushed me down the hall to Neil's room to meet Neil's father, who seemed relieved to carry on even a brief conversation about more comfortable topics related to the church. Then he said to Neil concerning his congregation, Neil's, "They ought to bring you communion." Turning to me, he said, "Neil was ordained an elder." Neil, who was sitting up on the bed trying to get air and get comfortable, managed to interject, "That was a long time ago." Sunday, May 21st. I wanted to go by to see Neil for a few minutes. I'd been thinking about how sick he was and that he might be missing his parents. So this afternoon I went by to see him, carrying with me a red rose from our garden. He was very ill, and he whispered to me that he had a fever. I touched his forehead. His hand felt cool against his hot My hand felt cool against his hot forehead. He reached up, took my hand, and held it tight against his chest. We stayed that way in silence. After a few minutes, he began to cough. I got him some water. He sat up to drink it. Then I told him I was going and would see him in a couple of days. He looked at the rose, and with great effort, he said, "The flower is beautiful. God be with you." Who is being ministered to here? Tuesday, May 23rd. I went first to see Neil. His fever was down to about 100 degrees. He still spoke in a whisper and with effort. We talked a little about his parents. He let me know he had a good relationship with them, and they were coming back to Los Angeles to be with him that weekend. Before I left, I let him know that a pastor, Reverend David Meekoff, was nearby, and I was pretty sure he would know Neil's parents. Would Neil like the pastor to contact his parents while they were in Los Angeles for the weekend? He looked surprised that this man, whom he had known as a child, was nearby. He said, "Just 5 minutes away?" I said, "Yes, just 5 minutes away. I'll call him if you want me to." He nodded yes. Then he said he was ready to rest. Throughout this conversation, he was holding my hand, or was I holding his? He was lying on top of the covers in his hospital gown. His legs were young and strong. I noticed his feet and ankles seemed swollen. Thursday morning, May 25th. I got a phone call at home from the social worker at the hospital. Pat, I wanted to let you know before you came in this afternoon that Neil has died. I hung up and began to cry. I was surprised by my tears. I felt I needed to do something, needed to get closure. Maybe I just wanted activity to blunt the sorrow. I phoned Reverend David Meekoff, the minister who was planning to visit Neil and his parents the next day, and told him the news. I had known Neil for 5 days and had spent maybe altogether 45 minutes with him. How could his death so affect me? But there was, with only a few words and intensity, he allowed me into the circle of his life in simple, direct ways during the last 2 days of his life. He held on to me, did not and could not hide his suffering. I had come to share it, and he allowed it. I have thrush, he had said, and displayed the fungus on his tongue. Does that create some swelling, I ask? Yes, he said. I have a fever, and I touched his head.
I had met 4 patients that first day, and within 43 days, 3 of the 4 had died. They had, in the meantime, had several hospitalizations. Tom, one of those patients who had been there the first day, died at 7:08 p.m. on June 30th in the hospital. His companion, Robert, was there with him, as he always was. A week or so later, Robert returned to the hospital to invite some of us to come to his home for a memorial service for Tom, and he included me in that invitation. And it was the first of many memorial services that I would attend, and this one became part of God's call to me.
Monday, July 17th. Yesterday, I attended memorial service for Tom. It was not in a church. It was held at the apartment Robert had shared with Tom. In the AIDS-affected community, memorial services in homes and apartments were going on frequently, but this was the first one I had attended. It was a small, attractive apartment with a little patio by the front door, large windows opening between the living room and the patio. People were arriving for about an hour until finally there were around 40 crowded into the living room or outside the open windows on the patio. I was one of the earlier arrivals, warmly greeted and introduced around by Robert as the volunteer who had visited Tom frequently. I was served a glass of champagne and sat in a canvas sling chair watching. A young gay couple, maybe in their 20s, arrived. One held a bunch of sunny-hued flowers. The young man looked uncomfortable, like boys at a funeral. What are we supposed to do, and how should we seem? A woman arrived with her infant. Robert greeted them and took the baby, cradling it, carrying it around the room, sharing this miracle of new life with guests, then holding it up in the air with love, as though to let everyone see this sign of hope among the milling of the bereaved. Later, Robert stood in the middle of the room and gathered our attention for a brief time of remembrance. Everyone was offered a glass of champagne for the toast to Tommy, as they all called him, the toast that would come. Robert stood in the midst of friends with a glass of champagne in one hand and a greeting card in the other. He told us the message on the card seemed to fit how Tommy would want to be remembered. And then he read it, his hands shaking hard, but he got through it and raised his glass in a toast to Tommy.
Really wrung my heart when I observed what Robert was going through. And he was such a loving man, and he was grieving so this loss, and yet he was, you know, trying to carry on as the person in charge of the memorial service, and I thought to myself, you know, where is the church that people are having to do their own memorial services? I just didn't understand how that was working that way. And God's Spirit began saying to me, perhaps you can help. So by 1990, I was wanting to find employment in the AIDS field, but I didn't know, you know, what it might be or what I might be suited for. And then I saw in the classified ads, which I had never really searched, I mean, that was not a way I normally would look for a job, but I saw this classified ad in the LA Times for a position at Cal State Long Beach for a program assistant. So I applied and I got an interview and they hired me. The young psychologist that I was to work with was just, I mean, he apparently had just said, I just need somebody to help me, and they had been willing to, you know, put the money out to get somebody. But he really didn't know what he wanted me to do. But we quickly sorted out, you know, some ways that I could be of help. And I became part of the planning team for trainings under a National Institute of Mental Health grant. And we were training social workers and healthcare workers and people who were coming into contact now with people with HIV or AIDS and were frightened, didn't know, you know, how to protect themselves. So the trainings were to help them to learn how to be safe in their work and also to be compassionate. So after a while, I learned that the project's most pressing need was that they had already finished 1 year of a 3-year grant from the NIMH to train physicians to get them to start, you know, really looking for AIDS in symptoms in their patients. Many of the physicians at that time would say, I don't have any of those kind of people in my practice. So that was a barrier that needed to be overcome. So I said, well, why don't I look into trying to, you know, get something going for training physicians. And so I got together a team of the doctors that I had gotten to know and be friends with at the Marina Hospital, and they formed a panel, and then I peddled them around to a lot of the hospitals in the Long Beach area, and they would have these noon continuing education for doctors events, and the doctors got a free lunch and they got their continuing medical education certificates. And we were very successful in this. And by the end of 1 year, we had served and trained 500 physicians, which was very exciting, not only to me, but also to the panel of doctors who were so thrilled that they were able to involve more doctors in the work. I had also there at that job had read an NIMH study that found that AIDS patients with spiritual support did a lot better than those without it. So I began contacting denominational headquarters, inquiring what they were doing and what kind of materials they had to, you know, get an idea of what the need might be or where the strengths might be. And one of the people that I talked to was Kathy Lyons with the United Methodist Board of Global Ministries. She was working very hard to try to develop materials and asked me if I would write a booklet on HIV/AIDS ministry. And I said, of course, I would be happy to do that. And so she and I worked together, and she lined up a bunch of people that I could contact, most of them Methodists, that that I could then interview for this booklet. We have some very cheery music going on. But one of the people that I added to the list was a Presbyterian clergyman who was in campus ministry. And he had recently told me that he was HIV positive, and he agreed to be interviewed. But he was so worried about his status being discovered at the university that he would not arrange for the interview to be in his office, but instead wanted to do it at the in the university parking lot in his little car. My recollection is this was a VW bug, but anyway, it was a really small car. He was kind of a tall, lanky guy, and so I met him at his car, and I did this taped interview with him. He in the driver's seat, and me with my tape recorder in the passenger seat. As he told me the story, it was a story, a very touching story, of notifying the church where he had been teaching a Sunday adult class. And he described meeting with the pastor and then sharing about his illness. Soon after, he received a letter from the session terminating his teaching with their congregation and reducing by 90% their financial support for his campus program. As he told me this story, he wept. He had hoped for pastoral care and support, and instead, he received rejection. His story was among those that I included in the booklet, which eventually got published by the Methodist, called HIV/AIDS, A Practical Guide for Pastors. I really loved my job at Cal State Long Beach, and I enjoyed the people I was working with a lot, but I did miss the one-on-one contact with patients that I had had when I was doing the volunteer work. So one day I picked up the phone and I called Reverend Janet Humphreys, who some of you may know. She was director of the Clinical Pastoral Education Program at UCLA at the time, and I knew her through Pacific Presbytery. And I said, Janet, if I were to get CPE training, what would be my chances of finding employment as a chaplain? She told me, your chances as a laywoman are zero. So I thanked her and put the idea out of my mind, or at least I thought that I did. In spring of 1991, I reluctantly left the job at Cal State Long Beach because Cecil and I were moving from Inglewood to Ventura. Some of my friends at the Cal State job had been making phone calls to people they had some acquaintance with up in Ventura to see if there would be a position for me, but there really was nothing up there that I could do, and the few jobs that were there were either filled or required a master's degree, which I did not have. So to make matters worse, and some of you may remember this, in 1991, we had a recession at that time, and the unemployment rate in the state of California was 10%. So it was really hard to find a job. Once we got to Ventura, I did some different things. I coordinated a man's run for city council. And when that was over, I developed a little fund development consulting business with nonprofits, writing funding proposals for nonprofits. And this was all work that I could do, but could never love. And I think maybe God's Spirit was working through the dreariness of those jobs. Then one day, sitting at home at my writing desk, I was going through the mail, and I opened up the Pacific Presbytery newsletter, and jumped out at me a little article by the associate director of the CPE program at UCLA. And among other things, he mentioned that they did accept lay people. And I think I already knew that, but that just leapt off the page at me, and I said to myself, I'm going to go for this. And within a week, I had applied and was accepted there, and I said to myself, you know, I don't have any more doubt about the rightness of doing this. I've been feeling a kind of a pull to do AIDS ministry now for a long time, and I'm going for it. And that was in spite of all evidence to the contrary. There were very few chaplaincy positions in all of Ventura County. Some of you from Ventura County remember how few there were. They depended on pastors to do all the calling. And there were none at any AIDS-serving agencies. In fact, there were only really two AIDS-serving agencies. There was the big immunology clinic, which served HIV/AIDS patients at Ventura County Medical Center, VCMC, and they had never had a chaplain at that hospital. And then when there was AIDS Care, which at that time was very small, with just a director and a part-time secretary. So it was with that unlikely situation that I began my training to be a chaplain for AIDS ministry. I was commuting twice a week, beginning 1992, to UCLA from Ventura, and every other weekend I had to stay at the hospital to do on-call. So I did get permission from the director to be able to do half of my pastoral care hours in Ventura County. And I approached Dr. John Prichard to see if he would allow me to do some chaplaincy internship at the immunology clinic, which he directed. And he agreed to have me there. So I became part of the HIV/AIDS team with a home health nurses, social workers, a psychologist, and Dr. Prichard. And the clinic operated out of two big adjoining trailers on the hospital grounds. So my sense of call was now morphing into ministry. And early on Tuesday mornings, I would attend case conference to learn about the patients that we would be seeing that day. And when clinic would start, the patients would line up seated in chairs like these all the way around the wall. And that was where I operated, in that waiting room. And Cecil used to call it doing ministry in the bus. So I must say, though, a bus might have offered a little more privacy than I had with in that situation. But I got to know the men and the few women who at that time were infected and coming to the clinic. And sometimes I was invited to go back to see somebody in an examining room. And occasionally Dr. Prichard would ask me to make a home visit. My very first home visit was to John, who, because of his declining health, had moved back in with his parents near Ojai. I had met his mother at clinic when she would come bringing him down the mountain to his appointments. But on the day that I visited John, neither of his parents were home. I remember sitting in their sunny living room, getting to know John, and I learned that he had had a pretty strained relationship with his father. They were just so very different. His father loved to fix cars, and he had no interest in auto repair. A few months after that home visit, it was clinic morning again, and Dr. Prichard urgently told me to that he wanted me to go across to the hospital, to ER, because John was in the ER. So I went across the hospital grounds in the back door leading to the ER. John's mother was sitting alone in the waiting area. She told me her husband had come down with her and was around somewhere. I went into an examining room to see John. He told me he wanted to speak with each of his parents, to thank them for everything. He asked if I would arrange for them to come in, and I said that I would. I hurried out, found his father, and brought him in to see John. And then I left them alone and went to where his mother was waiting. And I told her that John was speaking with her husband and also wanted to speak with her. And I took her in to see John. Then I went back to clinic. I learned, I think, the next day that just a few hours after I had been with them, that John had slipped into a coma. And later that night, he died. At the very end of his life, John was able to give this wonderful gift to his father. And his mother came in to tell me how much it had meant. You know, a couple of weeks later, I guess it was. And she said that it just had meant such a world to her husband for John to thank him for fixing his cars all through the years and how much he appreciated it. So I felt that God had put it in John's heart to offer that gift to his father in particular. And God was able to use me to get the gift delivered. Frequently on clinic day, staff from agencies like County Drug and Alcohol Program or AIDS Care would come over to talk to with the patients or with the clinical social workers. And one day, AIDS Care's brand new director, Doug Green, showed up. And we hit it off right away. He had grown up in a Presbyterian church. And in the course of the next 2 years, Doug would be a person that God sent to help me. I was eager to try a small group form of Lectio Divina I had learned in 1991. Lectio Divina, an ancient way of meditative way of reading scripture. And in November of that first year, with Dr. Prashard's approval, I offered what I called spiritual questing. I set it up to run for the 4 weeks of Advent. And I had flyers put up at the clinic and, you know, wherever else I could find a way to advertise it. And four men from the clinic committed to the four sessions. Scott had no religious background. Dell had been raised as a fundamentalist. Joseph, who was Latino, was a lapsed Roman Catholic. And Greg was a Presbyterian. They were there on time, and each Tuesday evening for that month. And at the conclusion, they gave me some suggestions. They said they really liked it, but it went kind of fast, and they suggested I pad it up a little bit. So I appreciated that, and was not able, though, to offer spiritual questing again for a couple of years. I was pretty worn out with the commute to UCLA, so I decided to do my last two units in Oxnard at St. John's Hospital in their small program. And during my second unit with them, I had an advanced project, and I decided I would do the spiritual questing again. So I had the opportunity to do it as an 8-week program. And I remembered the advice I got, so I added a few things that my supervisor and I decided on. And the first night that it was to start, just about this time of year, it was a big rainstorm. And I thought, oh my God, is anybody going to show up? Doug Green had done the recruiting and said that there were 8 of them, and he was going to come. I figured he maybe was going to check me out to see, you know, just what I was going to be doing. And I was really worried that nobody would come to this first one with, you know, a strange place and a woman that most of them had not met before. But they all showed up, and they showed up every week for spiritual questing. And when the last session was finishing up, and I, you know, reminded them that we would not be meeting again, they really did not want it to end. So Doug Green approached me about continuing the spiritual questing, and that AIDS Care would pay me to do it over there. So I continued it at that point as an AIDS Care program. And then Doug contracted with our friend now, Art McDermott, to see if he could write a grant proposal to find some money to pay me as a chaplain at AIDS Care, the first chaplain at AIDS Care. In 1995, I began that first job as a chaplain. Significantly, it was just at the point at which researchers were introducing the cocktail that promised to extend the lives of people with HIV and AIDS. And it coincided also with the publication by Erdmans of the journal that I had kept in 1989 and 90, AIDS and the Sleeping Church. And Ventura County Star, by its own volition, carried a full-page spread about the book. It was really a very heady time for me. It was also the year that I turned 60, so I had a great awareness of that. But I was not prepared for what lay ahead, for the difficulties of developing a ministry for which there was no pattern any place in the country. Outpatient chaplaincy was quite a new field at that time, and I used to call what I was doing at AIDS Care the exurbia of outpatient chaplaincy because it was way out beyond the suburbs. AIDS Care had about 150 clients, and they were spread out all over the county, and most of them were between 20 and 40, I would say. And most of them could no longer work, or at least not full-time jobs. So they were having very chaotic experiences at home. They were, you know, trying to keep everything together. And AIDS Care was providing food from a food pantry and housing vouchers and other practical and essential help. And by the time I came on board as a chaplain, they had just moved into a 2-story craftsman house in downtown Ventura. AIDS Care under Doug Green was growing rapidly, and he was doing his best to put together a staff to meet the needs of clients. The staff was young and wanting to help, but there were a lot of uneven edges around our staff configuration. And when I started, there were 2 women on the staff who took an active and, right out there dislike to me. They had never met me before. I don't know what their take on me was, but they made my first weeks there really pretty miserable. Fortunately, after a while, the one who was doing casework had a change of heart and came to rely on me to help give support to her clients and also for herself. And after the initial weeks, I started focusing on questions of organization for my position, and Joanne is going to read a short excerpt from an unpublished article that I wrote at that time.
I've been on the job now for 4 months. The good news is this past week was I remembered enough of who I am as a chaplain to have a flood of questions. I felt strangely energized and empowered by the questions coming to mind. During most of my first 4 months, I have felt overwhelmed by particularities. Where is the name of that woman I spoke with? I've got to remember to call her. Did I leave that blue spiritual support questionnaire with a guy's name on it out on my desk where it could be seen? I left one message for the woman who marked that she wanted to speak with me. Should I keep pursuing it, or is the ball in her court? Last week, I started seeing the larger questions of how chaplaincy might be structurally integrated into this setting. I long for the order I experienced in developed chaplain services departments. But AIDS ministry was my chaplaincy goal. Here I am with who I am and what I know. God's gift to me is the chance to do this work. Today, soon after I started the job, I was sitting at my donated computer with no printer, trying to conceptualize goals and objectives for this chaplaincy position. The computer screen was blank. I looked up at my CPE certificates on the wall before me and thought of the supervisors who had helped me, trained and encouraged me. I wanted to call one of them up and say, "What do I do now?" But they had done their job, and now it was up to me. I sat looking at my certificates and wept. Then I told myself, "You were trained and called to do this work. So pull yourself together and do it."
And with God's help, I did. I held the position for 5 years through three directors in two locations. We did the weekly spiritual questing groups, which Doug co-led with me, and they became the core of the AIDS care spiritual support program, and clients in those groups developed a very close relationship and a close sense of community. We also held twice a year spiritual support retreats at Casa de Maria. Some of you may have been there at different times. And most of our clients had never heard of a retreat before and were a little reticent to sign up for these at first. But after a couple of years, retreat spots were hard to come by. I canvassed Ventura County churches to ask for donations to cover the cost of what it would be for each person to go on one of these retreats. And we always got a very good response. And I would list all of the supporting churches and give that list to every retreatant. And they were so touched that people in the churches would be supporting them in that particular way. And then after the retreat, I would write up something about the retreat and I would give it to every church that had given a donation. I visited clients in the hospital and sometimes wrote prayers for them. And in my little office on the second floor of that craftsman house, I met privately with clients who grew comfortable sharing their about their addictions, their struggles with family members, their fears. Partners and family members began coming to see me after they had a loss, and I felt I needed more help, so I got some more training in grief care and began offering grief groups. And I had opportunities to conduct memorial services, which I never felt was my strong suit, but I had my copy of the services for occasions of pastoral care, and being there, I was able to allow grievers to grieve, and sometimes myself, and was able to put their grief into sacred space. Men and women I came to know allowed me to hear their stories and accompany them in finding hope. pray with them in both public and private settings, and send them forth with courage in January of 2000 when AIDS care closed. In that Isaiah 49 passage that Dan read today, we heard again the exile narrative of release and of homecoming. And as a chaplain in AIDS ministry, I believe that it was my task to level out a pathway for our clients so that they could find release and a sense of home, or whatever it might mean for that person, perhaps acceptance of themselves, perhaps finding trustworthy community, comfort in the face of fear, hope as they walked the tightrope in those years between knowledge of their diagnosis and the reality that they were still living, and always assurance that God was with them and in them. The clients and their families and friends confirmed my call, and I will always be grateful for that. At the conclusion of this now, I want to say that I'm so pleased that some of the people I have mentioned, and one that I did not mention, are here today, and I want to introduce them and have them stand up. Doug Green, who was the director of AIDS care at that time, and was such a tremendous support to me. He would go around town with me and introduce me as his chaplain. And Art McDermott, who was the one who wrote that original funding proposal. And Art was a devoted member of Spiritual Questing for 2 or 3 years until he moved to LA. And I just feel so privileged to continue to have these two men as friends. And our daughter Mary, whom some of you have met before. Our daughter Mary is a specialist in the use of the arts and journaling for healing. And every time I was starting to, you know, the planning process for a retreat, she would consult with me and come up with these fabulous organizing ways of doing the retreat around some new particular kind of expressive art. And the clients loved it, and it was such a wonderful gift, a gift to me and a gift to all of us. And I'm so grateful. She's always been such a support to me. So if there are questions, we have only just a couple of minutes, but I'll leave that up to Leon to decide about.
I see one hand already up. They can use your preacher's voice. Hold on, so we can hear.
I need the mic for my hearing.
Your book has gone out, and so has it led to other community organizations like yours?
No. I'm sorry to say.
Pat, I'm interested. How did you, when you had that circle of gentlemen, how did you protect yourself so you felt secure from the saliva? How did you do that?
I told them to not slobber on me. It was a strict rule. You know, it's really very hard to catch AIDS. Actually, it's quite hard, there has to be, the circumstances have to be right for it. So, being in a circle with people never was a problem.
Bill,
Pat. I think everyone here would say we needed to be here today and to hear your stories and the stories of everyone that you've described. Let me ask, What happened to Robert, the companion of the young man who died?
When my book came out in 95, I'll show you a cut. It was a beautiful book. when this came out in 95, I tried to get in touch with Robert to let him know. And he had moved, and I could not find a way to catch up with him. But I sent some free copies to the hospital, and the nurses were sitting around at the nurses' station. They would be reading, along with Dr. Murray, one of my favorite doctors there, an infectious disease nurse. She called me up. She says, "Oh, we are just loving this." And of course, I had changed a lot of the names. She said, "Tell me, was so-and-so really so-and-so?" The hospital staff was thrilled to be able to read about these people that they had come to really love.
Pat, I want to thank you for sharing this marvelous ministry with us and for letting God use you in such a magnificent way to reach a marvelous community of God's people. Thank you again for sharing that.